Because this thing is going to be in the way.
Oh, I see. Okay.
There you go.
Of our various talkings.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Bibbs. Thank you for that song.
I thought it was thematically appropriate.
It is thematically appropriate because I love the one I'm with right now.
Aww.
Yeah. And you love the coffee and donuts that I presented to you.
You presented, and they weren't just like, I would have taken them in like a bag. And you put them on, like, one of those plates that's, like, on top of an upside-down cup?
It's a pedestal. Pedestal platter.
All right. So I thank you for that. And that made donuts feel extra special.
That's why I have that thing.
And I appreciate
it. To serve people foods. It's very beautiful.
Yeah.
I took a picture of it, actually, and I put it on Facebook.
Did you take a picture of it, like, next to the toaster?
No. The toaster was last week.
No, I'm just saying. Like, you could just... The toaster is now, like... You know, like the Slender Man or like those watchers in Fringe where they're like in every picture, whether you realize it or not. You know? Who are you?
I'm Dave White. I'm the film critic for the Wrap. That's Alonzo Drowsy. I'm the film critic for movies.com. This is Linoleum Knife, a podcast of the cinema. And my substitute, Alonzo Drowsy, who is not with us this week, who is in fact in the real Kosovo.
Which is where he wanted to go to get away from
it all. Which was the MTV movie that they didn't make. They planned it after the real Cancun. But nobody went to see the real Cancun. And all the bikini sluts in Kosovo were busy at the hostel.
Yeah.
So,
God.
That's, yeah.
I remember when Real Cancun came out and there was like these sort of hushed whispers around it like, oh man, is this just like, are they just like putting porn in theaters now? Is that like what this is? Is this like one of those like Girls Gone Wild?
Yes.
But it's a movie?
Yes.
And it turns out everyone only wanted to watch that on the internet where they can do so with the privacy of their own pants.
Yeah. You don't want to without being alone.
And I've been bemoaning that lately. Like, sex has been driven out of the multiplex and into the home.
No, I know.
I want to experience, you know, those kinds of feelings, those kinds of uncomfortable / extremely comfortable feelings.
In public. And
in a darkened room filled with a lot of strangers.
You're in West Hollywood right now.
Yes.
And you can do that here.
I certainly can.
There's a theater about half a mile down the road called Studs.
And I miss
it's
the days.
The Studs Theater. And I know what you're fixing to say. You miss the days of?
When you could see the marquee.
When there was a marquee.
And you could see what movie was playing.
And they would put actual letters on the marquee to tell you the titles
it was
the pornography
now it
that they were showing.
Now it just says Studs. And I remember like the first time I drove past that theater.
They got lazy.
They did. But I'm like, the first time I drove past that theater, it said Raiders of the Lost Arse. And I got really excited for a second. And then I was like, oh, wait. And then I got really excited for another second. And then I was like, oh, right, I'm not gay.
Damn. I have a story.
I always wondered if that was just a title or not.
It is.
Damn it.
I used to take Polaroids of the marquee. I used to go there about once a week and take photographs, Polaroids of the marquee. And my favorite one.
You can do an art installation of
my
those?
My very favorite one. Well, here's what happened. My very favorite one, Dawson's Crack, was the occasion of my very first visit to this theater. Mm. Alonzo and I went because I was like, they're showing Dawson's Crack. We're going. We are now going. Like, we had talked about it. Like, let's go. Let's go. Because it's like, it's an old school pornography theater.
Yeah.
Let's go. Plus, it's for gays. That's us. So let's go. So they showed Dawson's Crack.
Alonzo is so mad right now that the conversation steered towards porn already.
And I take the picture of the marquee. And this is at the time of my early Los Angeles experience when I was writing for this Silver Lake-based style magazine called Glue.
Mm. I remember Glue.
And I handed it off to my editor. that photo of Dawson's Crack, and she ran it in the magazine with the caption, "Here's why we love Los Angeles." You know, like. Well, what happened later, though, was that that issue got in the hands of people who make, you know, junky little like t-shirts and buttons and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I started seeing the Dawson, my picture that I took, the Dawson's Crack marquee on little like buttons and cups and things in these Silver Lake, you know, hip shops.
What?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it is.
And sad because he didn't get any money for that.
I didn't get any money from that. That's too bad. It doesn't matter. I live on.
That's
what's great.
Yes.
So, I forgot what we were talking about. You are William Bibbiani.
Everyone calls me Bibbs.
You're the one I'm with.
That's right.
Right now.
Yeah.
And you are the film editor.
Yes.
Of CraveOnline.com.
That's correct. And the co-host of the B-Movies podcast.
The B-Movies podcast.
You can listen to me every Friday morning at about 9:45 on KFWB News 980.
That's right. You're also on the radio in Los Angeles.
I replaced Alonzo Duralde in that gig.
You did? Because I made really him quit.
That's right. I also have...
I really did make him quit.
I know you did.
I was like, you're not doing this anymore because...
I miss you on Friday mornings.
They're paying you, first of all. Secondly, yeah. It's taking time away from you developing linoleum-knife.com.
The best website in the world.
This is a dormant website at the moment because he's in Kosovo, and he's the only one that knows how to post things with pictures in them and videos. I'm so dumb. He shows me every day how to do it. Like, he gives me a little lesson every day when I need to post something. He's like, all right, I'm going to show you again. Like, I'm just going to learn through repetition.
Uh-huh.
But I'm...
The problem with that is you actually have to learn it. After the repetition,
but I've only repeated it like 4 or 5 times, and it takes me many times because there's like 17 steps.
Yeah,
to posting a picture.
Well, yeah,
on the site, and I haven't remembered.
Well, they don't want to make it so just anyone can do it. You know, there has to be some sort of screening process.
I am
on the internet.
Too relentlessly stupid. So, like, while he's gone, basically linoleum-knife.com is sort of. It's taking a nap until he comes home from Kosovo.
Okay.
It's a good thing that we've only been up and running for like 3 weeks because that means only about 9 people care.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And 2 of them are on the podcast
and
right
two,
now.
Yes. So the you're
doing all that.
You're my substitute husband today.
What?
That's kind of what you are.
What is that? What do I have to do? Where should my hand be right now? I
don't right where they are.
Oh my.
Right where
all
they
right.
are.
All right. We are going to be reviewing some films for you. It will not all just be canoodling. The canoodlingest podcast ever. So we're going to be reviewing a couple of exciting new features. Ron Howard's Rush.
Yes.
Someone's Battle of the Year.
Who did that? Who directed that?
Who knows? I don't know. No one knows.
Is it the Sony prototype robot director that they've invented?
It's the Cartman robot from that episode of South Park where he's like, Adam Sandler.
A Screen Gems film.
Puts together a gene team of B-boys. We got that. We got Prisoners with Hugh Jackman and Jake Gyllenhaal and a bunch of other actors.
Yes.
And Enough Said.
Yes.
Yeah. That's what we're going to be talking about.
How should we begin? What you choose. You chose the music.
I surprised
me with a lovely song.
Let's Rush.
All right.
It's your show.
Okay. Well, Rush is about what's his name?
Chris Hemsworth?
Hunt. What? Something.
James Hunt.
James Hunt.
Yeah. He sounds like a spy.
He was tall and blonde and super pretty.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've seen pictures of him compared to Chris Hemsworth, and it's hard to decide which one of them is prettier.
Which is amazingly difficult.
Yeah.
Like, oh my
God. Usually the movie version of a guy is the better looking version of the guy.
Generally speaking.
But there are some pictures of the real James Hunt on the internet where you're seeing him and you're like, oh dude, you're better looking than Chris Hemsworth. You know? What are you looking at right now?
Okay, so you know how we were like trying to figure
Apparently, William Bibbiani is making a weird face and looking at his phone.
I was trying to look up something because we couldn't remember like who directed Battle of the Year.
Yeah.
So I looked it up just so we would know for later, and then I couldn't resist my gasp. It was directed by Benson Lee, the director of Planet B-Boy.
What?
The documentary.
The documentary that the movie is based on.
Yeah, and is infinitely worse than.
A good documentary.
Yeah.
Well, then he's a good documentary filmmaker.
Yes.
And for all we know, here's the
thing. We're just going to review like a 30 seconds for each film in order.
Let's watch Battle. Let's talk about Battle of the Year.
I'll bleep it out. I'll bleep that out.
This is a no swears podcast.
I have a swears podcast personally, so it might happen again. It happened about 10:45.
It's a gay straight alliance today, but it's always a no swears.
Okay.
The thing about this dude is this his first narrative feature? Does your phone know these things?
My phone probably
My phone doesn't know anything. My phone is not a smartphone.
Okay. This
Louis C.K. supports my decision, too.
What do we got here? Yeah. This is his fifth film. His fourth film. He's got another one on the pipeline. Looks like he has done a dramatic thriller called Miss Monday. A writer suffering a block decides to watch a young woman as a role model for his novel, but finds more than he bargained for.
Never heard of it.
No one has.
So he might be actually becoming a good narrative filmmaker.
Yeah.
Someday. If he could, maybe he wants to write his own script.
Well, hang on
maybe
a second.
Maybe he's burdened by terrible material.
Well, hang on a second. Battle of the Year is nothing, it feels like nothing if not a studio product.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's nothing original or personable or unique.
Correct.
This feels like it was like, we said it before, it feels like it was made by a machine designed to make this movie.
Yes.
And as a result, it is terrible. It's really,
indeed
really bad.
It is.
There is no like, and here's the thing. This movie hits all the beats. Mm-hmm. This movie hits, you know, and it tries to turn
widowed,
a dance movie.
Widowed alcoholic coach.
The Mighty Ducks beginning, basically.
Yeah.
Widowed alcoholic coach, a ragtag team of misfits who just can't get along and who will get better at what they do as they learn to work as a team and over the course of various montages.
Yes.
There's a girl. Like, what?
Here's what I love about the girl. She walks in.
Yeah.
And they're all like, whoa, what's up? A woman coach? No way. Girls don't dance.
She should have done the entire movie backwards and in heels. Like, just walked in every scene backwards and in heels.
And she shows up, and they're like, this is your choreographer. And everyone says, no, she ain't. She's like, yeah, I am. Yeah. And Chris Brown is like, I'm going to get with you. And she's like, no, you're not. And then she disappears from the movie.
She's around. She's in the background choreographing. And then she has one scene where she has dinner with Josh Holloway in which they talk about nothing having to do with her character. We don't know who she is.
No.
We don't know her name.
No.
I think she might have mentioned it once. There's no romantic subplot, which is actually kind of refreshing. Actually, it's kind of refreshing that they didn't force her to, like, you know,
make outs with him.
Yeah, or God forbid, Chris Brown. Chris Brown, who a lot of people are theorizing is the reason why this movie was delayed like 2 years because of his Chris Brownness.
Well, that's why we're just going to spoil it.
Mm.
In the middle of the movie, he gets a foot injury.
He's doing the dumbest thing ever.
And then
basically just saying, hey guys, you want to see me get a foot injury?
And then he disappears from the movie.
Yeah.
And
well, that's supposed to be our, oh man, they're losing their best B-boy.
No.
But there's no indication that he's that good.
No.
This is the trouble with, and it's the trouble with even movies in the genre that I really love, like the Step Up movies, which the B-Movies podcast recently compared favorably to Citizen Kane and declared the best movies ever made.
Yes.
On the official record.
Yes.
But it's a problem those have too, which is sometimes everyone is so good that when they're competing in like this artistic milieu, it's difficult to tell who's supposed to be better than the other one. Like this ends with a big dance battle between the best American B-boys and the best Korean B-boys, and I don't know why either of them should have won.
Correct.
You know, like in sports, it's because they got more points. Okay, fine. I can understand that. That makes a certain degree of sense.
Yes.
In a fight, it's whoever beat the pulp out of another guy.
Right.
That's fine. I get that. Here, they're all quite exceptional, and I don't know why.
And you don't even have a shot of the judges conferring.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, Padma Lakshmi is not there being like, Well,
I don't know that name.
His popping and locking is just a little less finesse.
They talk about synchronicity. Oh, man, they're so synchronous. You haven't seen synchronicity on this scale before. And I'm like, that guy's not kind of that synchronous, actually. Like, I'm looking at it.
Yeah, and the word is synchronization. And they keep saying synchronicity, which is not the thing that they think it is.
I don't know if it is.
Like, Duralde this morning on Facebook saying something that is nonplussed, and I was like, "Oh, I see you're using the what is now known as the informal use of that word, aka the wrong definition of nonplussed."
You are plussed, if anything, sir.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. You're super plussed.
Yeah, but this movie, what this movie is, I think, is trying to do, like, if it's trying to do anything, is it's trying to turn, like, these dance movies into like, a sports movie, like Coach Carter kind of thing, where it's, like, it's important of, you know, teamwork and showing it from, like, the coach's perspective, but it shows it from no one's perspective. Like, no one has a perspective in this. Like, Josh Peck probably gets the most character out of anyone. Everyone else gets a bullet point.
He has all the funny lines.
Yeah.
All the intentionally funny lines.
And the weird self-deprecating Jewish thing, which is like, he constantly talking about, I wish I wasn't Jewish so I could dance. And I'm like, what the hell? What are we doing here? I thought we were past that as a culture. But, like, Josh Holloway is an alcoholic. One other guy is homophobic. Another guy is...
Right.
Homosexual.
Homo.
Yeah. One guy is a jerk to another guy. Another guy is a jerk to that other guy. For reasons.
Yeah.
Another guy... this is his only shot at the big time. Another guy has, like, a baby. And, like, that's it. And it's like... When Chris Brown gets, like, knocked out of the film, it's like, oh, man, I feel nothing. I feel nothing whatsoever right now because I don't know who that is. I don't know why he matters. I don't know where they came from. Like, this movie is missing, like, a first act.
Yeah.
Where we set up who everyone is so that when they interact, it matters.
It's also missing a lot of dancing. You don't get to see
really
like,
terrible,
complete
yeah.
dancing until like the end of the movie.
And even then, you don't. And even then it's like, it's cutting around it and everything. It's like, and it's like, you know, it seems like they hired real dancers for a lot of this. So, like, surely
all
you can get
guys,
them to actually
them up,
do this.
All these guys is like their first film credit.
Yeah.
Because they're just they're dancers.
What is it? And they all have wonderful dancing names.
They got amazing dancing
names. What was your dancing name? You came up with your dancing name.
Lord Butterfat.
Mine was Dr. Crunkin Funkin Dunkenstein.
Yes.
Yeah.
They all had names like Kill and Sniper and Mayhem.
Lil Adonis with an apostrophe.
Lil Adonis.
Rooster. Because he's a rooster.
Yeah. And my favorite of them all, Intricate.
Which you know is spelled with like without the E and with a K.
It's spelled like the word intricate.
Oh, is it really? Yeah, I lost respect for them then.
But I love all these other guys who are like, yeah, man, my name is Mayhem, my name is Sniper, my name is Kill, and the other guy's like, mine is Intricate.
And he's not the gay one.
I'm known as Intricate. No, the gay one is Lil Adonis.
Who is he the most Adonis-like in the cast?
He's the shortest one, which is why they call him Lil. He's a Lil Adonis.
He's just Lil Adonis.
He's just a little wee little micro
look
Adonis.
Him. He's so cute. Yeah.
And I will give the movie this.
Mm-hmm.
They do not take... They only use his character to make a dumb after-school special sort of, you know... become friends with the homophobe storyline.
Uh-huh.
They don't. In a film as dumb as this, you would expect them to, since they've already gone down the Jews can't dance road. You would expect them to have gone down the whole, well, here's what gays are like, you know?
Yeah, like there'd be like a montage where like you take him shopping or something.
Exactly.
Or
fixing, you know, giving someone a makeover, you know, like terrible.
Yeah.
Something terrible and wrongheaded.
Well, it's interesting to me that
they don't do that.
That this movie is like enlightened, well, enlightened is an exaggerated word, but like it's trying to be enlightened about homosexuality, but it completely backtracks like three decades with Jews.
Yeah.
What are you doing? It's ridiculous.
Well, it's the reason for the Holocaust. You know, the Jews couldn't dance.
Yes. Wow.
So,
I mean, if they could pop and lock as well as Chris Brown does in this film,
it would be a whole different story.
We're monsters. This movie is just.
Let's talk about the product placement.
Okay. Oh, there's a scene where like they're all like brought in, and like the concept is
that it is a Screen Gems film, Sony.
Yeah. There's the concept of this film is. that they're all being like funded by this rich B-boy company or something.
Yes.
Like, we invented B-boy. If B-boy goes out of style in America, we're going to lose all our jobs. And I'm like, maybe you should diversify, but all right, yeah, whatever, let's go with this. Yeah,
the reason for this whole thing is so the guy doesn't lose money.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm losing money. I need a team.
Yeah.
I need a dream team.
And he's not even like this angry white guy with jowls. Like, I wanted to hear him like yell at Joshua, like, you're fired. Yeah, like, I want that. But I think I've done that on your show before, actually.
Maybe you have.
But so, like, there's a scene where, like, Josh Holloway is, he used to be a B-boy, and we never see him dance for 1 second.
Was he?
Yes. They constantly talk about, like, he was in our B-boy crew, and, like, we were just a bunch of guys before he came along, and he brought us together. He neither pops, nor locks, nor soft shoes.
Nor cabbage patches.
He doesn't so much as do the twist. Like, Damon Wayans in Major Pain does more dancing than Josh Holloway does, and he's good at it.
Yeah.
But that's not my DVD recommendation. So he has to catch up on the decades he's missed of B-boying.
Yeah.
There's a scene where Josh Peck comes in and he's like this intern. And he's like, well, you've seen Planet B-Boy, right? And he's like, it's our Bible. And he just totally talks about how great the director's last film was for like a minute and a half.
Yeah.
And then he's like, well, I'll show you. And then he picks up this little weird piece of plastic with like a screen on it. And it's like, Josh Holloway's like, what is this? To which Josh Peck says,
it's the Sony tablet. It's the future. Great. That's good. Thank you. Thank you, Sony Products.
And then he proceeds to open up a Netflix application and then, like, slide it onto the screen across the room, which I didn't know you could do. Which actually, that's kind of cool. But then, like, they're watching it, and I don't remember, but I feel like there's this, like, Finding Forrester montage of them, like, watching it with, like, awe faces, like they've just found God. That may or may not be in the film, but that feels like
100 hours of stuff.
They watch 100 in, like, 2 days. Yeah. And then they you see that they fell asleep at their desk watching Planet B-Boy.
Yeah.
And when they wake up, it's on the DVD menu screen.
Yeah.
Which Netflix doesn't have.
Right.
So what?
Everything is wrong.
Everything is wrong.
Everything is wrong
in this movie. And it's so formulaic. And the formula, listen, the sports formula works consistently, like in every single movie, because it's emotionally satisfying. You want to see guys who seem like they don't have a shot, better themselves, achieve discipline and physical perfection, and then beat a bad guy or at least a worthy opponent, and then be heroes. You know, that's satisfying.
I couldn't give one less heck than I already give about sports.
Yeah, me either.
But in sports movies, I'm super in love with all the sports movies.
Because it's a really great dramatic device. It puts everyone in a consistently active...
Also, I learned things about the sports while I'm watching.
Yeah, but there's a consistently active dramatic device that's being come back to all the time. Everyone's in direct competition with each other, and I think sports... And I'm with you on that. I don't follow sports. I don't really care. But I would care if I knew everyone...
You're a failure as a heterosexual.
I've never said I wasn't. But, it, you know, if I knew why everyone was playing,
that's
what
was
at
stake for them.
That's
a joke that should have been in Battle of the Year, really.
Yeah.
about Lil Adonis.
I'm just keeping
it real.
No, but again, here's my point. In a sports movie, I know why everyone is doing this. I know what's at stake, and so I care. Here, I don't know what's at stake for these guys. I don't know what they're like. There's one guy who's like, this is my only chance to do this. And I'm like, yeah, so you're just like everyone else. What? I don't care. Are you trying to like save it? If you're not saving a youth shelter, at least you're making a bad sports movie. If no one's father will love them otherwise, then.
At least in Honey, they had to save the youth center.
Yeah.
Honey's great, by the
way. Okay, I haven't seen Honey. I'm sorry.
You haven't seen Honey?
I haven't seen Honey.
Now you're a real disappointment as a heterosexual because that's got Jessica Alba.
I haven't found Jessica Alba attractive on screen since Idle Hands.
I don't understand you.
She's not my type. All right, that's the end. That's the end all be all. Right,
I guess.
I like him pretty. So.
oh.
Take that, Jessica Alba, who is clearly listening right now. And if you are listening, you seem like a very nice person, and I thought Into the Blue was underrated. So,
this movie, I felt
nothing. I don't care. Even, like, the contrivances that would normally at least get, like, a brief, like, oh, this is kind of neat. Didn't care.
Yeah.
Complete waste of time. And, like, it's not even, like, fun bad.
No.
It's just... it's like it's barely competent enough to not even be worth seeing if you like bad movies. So, but Rush is a good sports movie.
Yeah.
Rush is a really good
now
sports movie.
Now we can
movie.
Talk about Rush.
Yeah. I'm really hot and cold on Ron Howard movies.
I'm mostly, almost entirely always cold.
Yeah, I mean, like, he started off really strong.
Grand Theft Auto is fun.
Okay.
Splash is
fun.
Apollo 13 is great.
Willow is a really fun movie. I like Willow a lot. I was at the honestly, right age when Willow
yeah,
came out,
yeah.
to be perfectly honest. Apollo 13 is awesome. Parenthood, I think, is a great movie.
I remember liking Parenthood.
Yeah.
I don't remember anything about it, though.
I saw it maybe a few years ago. Yeah. I think it holds up. It's pretty good.
But then came everything else.
The Grinch was terrible. The Da Vinci Code was terrible. Beautiful Mind is like well produced, but it's so trite.
It's really
frustrating. Angels and Demons was kind of fun as like a 2-star potboiler because it had like a ticking clock and it kept the story moving.
It had Ewan McGregor helicopter parachuting
right.
priest
saving the Vatican from a bomb explosion. So that's it's hard to hate that.
Yeah.
And Frost Nixon was all right.
It was yeah.
That's that like it's a, not bad, but it's
fine,
not great.
A fine movie for grown-up people.
Yeah, so I would say Rush is, and this is kind of damning with faint praise. I think Rush is one of his best movies.
It is.
Yeah.
No, it absolutely is. Like,
yeah.
I don't right now. If I could just erase all the bad memories of all the other bad Ron Howard movies I've seen.
You'd say this Ron Howard guy has got a few real future.
He's got a real future.
Yeah.
Because it's about James Hunt, and it's about...
Niki Lauda.
Niki Lauda.
Yeah.
Played by Daniel Brühl, who's been in a million things, but mostly...
He's never had, like, a highlight film before.
No,
he's never been the focus.
He's been in a million things. He was in Inglourious Basterds. That's, like, the thing that you would probably have known him from.
Yeah.
James Hunt is the, beautiful, charismatic, womanizing, partying guy. This stuff is like, water off a duck's back for him. Like, he just gets in the car and goes, vroom, and he wins, and he's so great, and he's intuitive. And
we compared him to Maverick on our podcast. He's Maverick.
And Niki Lauda is, meticulous, and he plans, and he's, he's nearly monastic when it comes to racing. Like, he has... extreme discipline and the fact that he winds up with, this beautiful wife, you're thinking, where did you have time to do that? You've been only, racing and thinking about racing this
whole time. Well, they have to put him out of his way to even get him to meet a girl.
And So they have they have a career rivalry.
Yes.
And they're both really great at what they do. Mm-hmm. So it's not like one is clearly better than the other.
Well, and that's the thing that we see in a lot of sports movies is like either one of them is clearly better than the other, one of them is clearly evil and needs to be taken down a peg.
And neither of them are evil.
Neither of them are evil. They both have completely different disciplines and values. Yeah. They're both comparably, if not equally good at what they do, albeit in different ways.
Yeah.
And the film basically just starts off when they're both rookies.
Mm-hmm.
And then ends when they're both, and this is a real story, so there's not much of a spoiler, when they're both basically world champions.
Right.
And it shows how they raced on and off the track to greatness in their own personal lives and everything, and went from absolutely hating each other to begrudgingly respecting each other to genuinely respecting each other but still being competitors.
And there's this interesting sort of like, as the film, presents it. It's almost like a romance.
It is.
There's attraction and repulsion, and they need each other.
Well, at the beginning of the film, you can't imagine them together. At the end of the film, you kind of can't imagine them apart.
Apart. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the definition of a good
and
romantic comedy. Any romance, really.
They become, necessary to each other commercially. As well, because you realize that, like, Formula One racing sort of likes them as a team to play off of each other, and it makes everybody a lot of money.
All the interviews, and I've noticed this, and I never really thought about it too much before, but, like, all the interviews in this kind of sporting event, any sporting event is based on, like, individuals directly competing, like Formula One racing or boxing or even wrestling to a different extent. The interviews aren't about, like, what's your strategy. It's mostly just, like, so... What kind of egotistical bravado do you want to present to us now? Because that'll make for good drama.
It's all trash
and so
talk.
We'll care.
Yeah,
and that's good drama. That leads to good drama.
And it looks good. I mean, the movie really looks good. It's just big and and bright, and there's mm-hmm. you know, tons of great, you know, racing moments, and everything's mm-hmm. like fast, and the camera's in the car, and then mm-hmm. the tires are coming off, and it's a wet track, and it's danger. And
this was Ron Howard's pitch when he yeah. sold the film. That's a word for word.
Yeah,
I don't know how you found that document, but
yeah. was super into it.
Yeah.
Now, having said that,
yes.
the script. By
Peter Morgan.
Peter Morgan, who wrote The Queen and Frost Nixon.
Yeah.
There's less of this irritating thing in this script than there is in, say, Frost Nixon, mm-hmm. but it is still there. After showing you cinematically yeah. stuff, then they stop and they tell you about all the things they just showed.
Well, give me an example. Give me a specific example.
The movie ends with a long yes. conversation between
Hunt and Lauda,
where they pretty much explain to each other the thing that they did just now in the last hour.
They recap where they've come from yeah. and where they've gone.
And it's yeah. And the thing is that you didn't need that unless the audience, as I told you the other day, yeah. is studying for an advanced placement exam in Ron Howard.
Right.
You know, you don't need this stuff.
You know, you told me this before I'd seen the film, because you saw it like a day before I did. Mm. And it is the sort of thing Ron Howard does. I think in this particular instance, I'm not going to defend how blunt it is, mm-hmm. but I think the scene was needed. I don't think you can make this film and not end with a scene with them together, because otherwise they end apart and there's not really a satisfying
coda. Well, I don't have a problem with a scene of them together.
No, exactly. And I honestly like mm-hmm. that after all of this, and yeah, okay, maybe the audience didn't need it spelled out, but I liked clarifying that they were mature enough to understand the impact that they've had on each other's yes. life. I think that is actually a very satisfying, even if it's badly spoken,
yes.
Ending to a film, which is here are these guys who are extremely hot-headed, who are, you know, at some point it seems like they're never going to change. It's just who they are,
right.
And they're capable of saying, you know what, all these things that I used to hate about you, they've made me better at what I do.
Right.
And I like that about the film, even if it wasn't, regardless of how it was expressed. I like that we have a film here about rivalry that doesn't devolve into murder. Because how often? Like, sir, I was trying to, we do on my podcast, we do B-movie recommendations where we look at a film that came out this week and we think of another movie that's yes. kind of like it that maybe you haven't seen.
Yeah.
And I was trying to think of another movie in which two guys were rivalry, or women or whatever, where two people were rivals. And it never got ugly.
Right.
You know, at the end, they brought out the best in each other, and they both yeah. sort of succeeded, which is kind of the idea of sports.
Yes.
It's kind of the idea of any competition.
Yes.
And even, like, ones I love, like, my favorite movie is Searching for Bobby Fischer, and even yeah. that one has the evil kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And, like, here's one where it's like they're both mature about what they're doing.
Yes.
And I think that's really wonderful, actually. And even if the movie... And the movie's not brilliant. It's just very well made.
Yeah.
Even if the movie
were... There's nothing transcendent about this film.
No, it's just
really
think it's,
good.
I think the fact that it really explores that theme and doesn't go for the easy melodrama
yeah.
about it, I think that makes it, if nothing else, at least a little admirable.
Yeah.
You know, and its intent. And so, yeah, I ended up... I was joking about how much I kind of didn't want to see this movie because Ron Howard's burned me so often. And the mm-hmm. posters are terrible. The poster is just Chris Hemsworth's face and like one sentence like yeah, on his nose.
Right.
And I'm like, who did that? That's yeah. terrible. I wasn't looking forward to it.
The tagline could as well have been something like, he's got a fast car. You know, like, it doesn't matter.
Exactly.
Look at how handsome this dude is. That's yeah. the name of this movie.
Yeah, basically. And he yeah. is. And you get to see his butt.
You do see his butt.
Or at least his body doubles, but it looks like it should be his butt.
It's his.
Yeah, it looks yeah. fantastic.
He's that guy yeah. who...
There's a lot of butts and nipples for a Ron Howard movie.
Mm-hmm.
He's usually very yeah. safe
oh, yeah.
as a director, you know?
He's entered the butt and nipple phase of his directorial career.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing that I thought was interesting, it kind of reminded me of Lee Daniels' The Butler, which, by the way, is this Lee Daniels... No. There is, however, a moment... In Rush, where I think Chris Hemsworth calls someone the C word, and it's drowned out by like a car horn.
yeah.
Which they did a lot in Lee Daniels' The Butler.
Yeah.
And I was confused by this one. I'm like, maybe we could go for an R rating, maybe PG-13,
right.
whatever. With Lee Daniels' The Butler, it's like, you know they're going to want to show this in high schools. Why do you put a joke about a woman's wide genitalia
yes.
in your film? Like, why even film that?
Because Lee Daniels is a...
Great. Yes, he is. Now, here's my question, though, because you guys posited, and you posited this recently,
yeah.
That the second film with a title, or in some rare cases, the inferior film, with the same title will be Lee Daniels as so-and-so.
Yes.
So is this Lee Daniels as Rush, or is the Jason Patrick film Lee Daniels as Rush?
That's so hard to make a choice.
Because they're very different.
This is the second one.
They're both good movies.
This is the second
one. This is the second one, but is there a qualitative difference?
No, there's not.
Okay.
They're both good movies.
They're both good movies. So just by default, this one must be Lee Daniels.
I think I'm more into the Jennifer Jason Leigh, Jason Patrick Rush.
Yeah.
Just because...
The song?
I am, yeah.
Okay.
I'm even more so into the Paula Abdul song, Rush, Rush. That's my number one thing with the word Rush in it. And then the Rush number two is the...
For me, it's Premium Rush all the way.
I know.
Yeah.
I saw that movie with you.
And it was a delight.
I saw how you behaved during that film.
I was uncontrollably filled with glee during that movie. I was like a little kid. I saw Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs yesterday, and I wanted to strangle every child. Yeah, I did. I wanted to strangle every child in the room.
I'm seeing it tomorrow.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, but I want to strangle every child in the room, and you just made me realize that's how I was in Premium Rush. Because I couldn't control my glee. It was amazing.
You were like a child watching Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
But it was so much fun, and I still don't care.
After Premium Rush, some people in the coming like week or so said to me, "Who's your friend?" And I was like, "Who are you talking about?"
Oh,
and they're
no.
like, "The guy that was so into it." And I was like, "I don't know who that is."
thank you for helping me save face.
I don't know him.
I've become aware that I might approach what I do with too much enthusiasm as opposed to everyone else, who I guess is just really jaded and proud of it.
Yes, we are. We're jaded and we're proud.
I refuse to be jaded. No. I can't do it. I love what I do.
I admire your childlike glee.
I've been trying to, ever since I got called out on Rotten
Tomatoes.
Who called
you out?
Rotten Tomatoes Radio. Someone tweeted me. It's like, yeah, they're just saying, like, whatever you do, never sit next to Bibbs in a movie.
Yeah, that was us.
Oh, that was you. You were on that. Yeah.
That was me and Greg.
Thank you for that.
We were talking about how crazy you act in movies sometimes.
Okay, all right. See, yeah, and so I've been trying since then, since you called me out in public.
In that moment where someone asked me if you were my friend, I said no. But on the radio, of course, I'll be like, oh yeah, William Bibbiani.
Yeah.
In a screening. I compared you to my friend Gary Cotty, who is my other very loud friend.
Thank you.
He and Gray, when they get together, because I was calling out Gray to her face.
Mm. I saw her go completely nuts at Step Up Revolution, by the way.
But
I was with her on that.
Yeah,
we were all going nuts at Step Up Revolution.
She's my other very loud friend.
Yeah.
And when she and Gary Cotty are together in a movie screening experience, they should be kicked out of the theater. So you can't even hold a candle to these two.
Thank you.
When you get...
thank you.
Loudness, my friend Gary Cotty, then Gray. Then you.
Wow.
Yeah. So you're number three. You're number three loud.
I can handle that. That's one time where three is actually best. Okay.
So
thank you.
I don't know if I would call it calling you out. Just sort of, you know.
I was exaggerating for mild comedic effect.
Identifying.
My point is
your manner.
My point is, I'm trying to be. I am trying to put on a good face. I'm trying to be more mature. Well, no, my face is gorgeous. I'm not saying that. I'm just. Yeah. I'm trying to be better at what I do.
It is a handsome face.
Yes, because I want to get in critic societies. Call me. But no. So we have other films to review, and that's what I'm going to.
Super dorks who are in critic societies.
Okay.
It's just a matter of time.
I'm working on it.
You don't have to change one bit.
I think I do.
Wait till you get into the critic societies.
I can't.
Wait till you do, because you will see that nothing you ever attempted in terms of maturity or decorum or behavior mattered.
Good.
Because
that's what I want.
There are some straight up weirdos. I'm not in any.
I want to be disillusioned so bad.
Societies.
Yeah.
I'm not in any critics groups.
Yeah.
But Alonzo Duralde is.
Yeah.
And
I imagine fancy Oriental rugs and leather chairs and tea and like days where you come into the clubhouse and no sounds are allowed. Like
you
top
have
hat.
A better chance of that you happening know? In this apartment.
Is that a top hat?
Than in the film society critic group that you are aspiring to be a part of.
Was the club where no one's allowed to like make any noise whatsoever and then Fred Astaire tap dances, is that top hat?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, we got to move on because we have two other films.
Yes.
Which one do you want to talk about, Dave?
Enough Said.
You want to talk about Enough Said?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you saw this before me, again.
Yeah.
Because I had a very busy week.
Yes.
And you love this movie.
I do love this movie.
Okay.
The more I think about it, the more I love it.
See, the more I think about it, the less I love it, actually. This is going to be interesting.
Formally, I don't think this is a particularly interesting film. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's shot all that interestingly. I don't think it looks all that amazing. I don't think it's entirely as cinematic as I would like it to be. But content-wise... Uh-huh. I'm super into it because I love Nicole Holofcener. I love her take on this very specific type of Los Angeles person.
Right.
Occasionally New York people, but mostly Los Angeles people. Please Give was set in New York, but all the others are set here.
Okay.
And I think she occupies that sort of, you know, urban, smart, neurotic space that Woody Allen did in the 70s.
Yeah.
And I love that she satirizes her people, but also takes them seriously.
Well, she allows them to be funny.
Mundane, silly, funny problems are just those things. I like that she goes down some paths that most filmmakers never go down. She is very willing and very enthusiastic, I feel, talking about issues of poverty and wealth among these people. About who is a have and who is a have not. In movies like Friends with Money, Please Give is all about that. And even in this one, she kind of knows that she has to tone down their standard of living to make you really care about them. Normal jobs that they both have.
Well, I think that's actually like a wise choice. And like, part of what I like about this movie and part of what I don't like about it is sort of the story structure and the construction of it. Mm-hmm. And I think if both of these people were like rich, then I think the story about how you judge people when you first meet them and over time would have that one other factor, which is how good a provider is he. And if you're both, yeah, you're doing okay. You have your own house, you know. But like, if you're both
not struggling,
you're not struggling. But there's no level of he's a good provider or anything. Then therefore, that will affect my judgment of him. That can't enter into it. That's something you have to neutralize. So I think that was wise, and I think making it just a little bit more turquoise color, you know. just
so the story is about James Gandolfini as a television archive librarian who meets Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who is a massage therapist. At a party, they don't find each other attractive, although I think he thinks she's kind of
I think she's kind of cute, but she says that no one at the party is attractive.
She's immediately sort of abrasive about, one here is good looking.
He's kind of defending his feelings a little bit, yeah.
But then eventually they do sort of warm to each other. They start going out on dates. She, meanwhile, has a new massage client, played by Catherine Keener, who is a poetess. And
just,
is really well, really like well off. Like, apparently she's the richest poet in the world. and Julia Louis-Dreyfus aspires to everything about Catherine Keener's life.
Yes.
Her life, her wisdom, her
she starts
her
doing
skill,
things like, you know, well,
home, the for possessions
like
in the
home. Catherine Keener's family takes off their shoes when they go in the house, and therefore my family must too now.
Yeah,
like
starts, exactly. It's the thing we're doing now at our house. So she really, really, she meets that kind of friend that you aspire to be, and you sort of...
You're a little jealous of.
You have a crush on them in a way that you're sort of like, I want to be just like you, you know?
Yeah.
And then she
It's like the two guys in Battle of the Year, where one of them is genuinely talented and the other one has to work hard for it.
Right.
Yeah.
So then...
good parallel there.
She learns that when Catherine Keener is bad-mouthing her fat... lumpen loser of an ex-husband, she's talking about James Gandolfini.
What?
That they were married.
Oh my,
and here's
science!
The
what?
Sitcom-y thing that happens, which was unnecessary.
It's really contrived.
And
it's really contrived.
They could have just been like, oh yeah, we used to be married, and here's what a garbage person he is.
Yeah.
And she might have still come to the same conclusions about James Gandolfini.
See, I think that's the thing.
Does.
I think that's one of the problems with the film, is that it's trying so hard to shoehorn in this deception.
Yeah.
And I think it neglects to realize that the point of the film, and here's what I really admire about the film, is that it's a romantic comedy with a point. And it's a point about how we treat people, it's a point about how we talk about people, it's a point about how we judge people over various lengths of time.
To the people that you're in love with.
Yes, and how you talk to people about the people you're in love with.
Like last week on this show, and Alonzo Duralde called me a cow. How dare he?
Wow. I didn't even catch that.
He called me
a cow.
That
is messed up.
Yeah.
That is messed up. You, sir.
He's not here to defend himself now. I can make things right.
He just meant that you have juicy haunches.
I really do.
But, you know, that's kind of the point of this. And you don't really need the deception. Because here's the thing with this movie, and here's the thing that frustrates me. I think it's very telling that you said this is a film about James Gandolfini, whereas really this is a film about Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Yeah.
That she's the structure. Well, she's the center of the film.
I could have flipped their names.
Well,
to say
no, that, but yeah. It's interesting to me that that's your focus, because I think that might be part of why you like the film, because you're really relating to him and liking him. And I think that's the problem, is that you like him too much. I think that's the problem, is that we as the audience like him too much.
Mm-hmm.
Because what the film is about a woman who is only starting to judge and then get over her own initial judgments of a guy who, on the surface, isn't someone she'd normally be attractive to. He's
right.
Overweight, he's, you know,
right.
He's not her type. And then she meets someone who's known him for a very long time and has different judgments about him,
yeah.
And she starts letting that influence her. And
yes.
In order for the movie, I think, to be entirely successful, we have to see validity in both of those judgments.
Yes.
And there are two problems with that. One, Catherine Keener is way too two-dimensionally shallow and judgmental for me to ever truly believe her. And two, James Gandolfini is too awesome.
Mm-hmm.
He's extremely awesome. He's wonderful. He's charming. He's great. Yeah, he's a little flawed, but like in awesome ways.
Yeah.
And that would be fine, except we don't get any scenes with him alone. We never see him on his own. So structurally, the movie functions if he's a blank slate, and we're supposed to be trying to figure out, is the person who's known him for a long time best at judging him, is the person who's only just met him and maybe not as jaded judging him, and instead it just. And add on the element of deception, and then I'm judging everyone who's judging James Gandolfini really poorly.
Yeah,
and for a film about judgment, it's making me too judgmental and making me too defensive about someone
about
when really everyone
people,
should have a valid point. And so that's why I don't. And it's still fun. Like everyone's really wonderful in it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of funny jokes in it,
but
that don't feel like jokes. I just feel like genuine human interactions.
Yeah.
I'm not the hugest Julia Louis-Dreyfus fan. She's fine. I just never get excited to see her.
Right.
She's great in this. This is the best I've ever seen her.
Yeah.
It's charming. But for a film that very clearly has a point to make, or at least an argument to discuss, I think the inherent structure of the film belies that. I think it undermines it and makes it less than great.
Right.
But it's still good. I still recommend you see it. It's fun. It's a sweet film.
I appreciate your point about that, because in a way I do agree with you.
Mm.
I feel like there were elements of the story where I think it was a directorial choice for her to make Gandolfini almost unassailable, in spite of, because in the world of movies, the deck is already stacked against him.
Yeah,
he is already by every film making standard.
He's too old. He's too bald. He's too overweight.
Too old. Too bald. Too fat. He's
fat,
not supposed
to be.
He's not supposed to be a romantic lead.
Yes,
and I
find it refreshing that he is, honestly.
And
Deacon
it's
is an overweight
amazing
guy.
That he is, because that's, I think, a very real and very important thing. He doesn't look like Chris Hemsworth. He looks like everyone else. And everybody else in the real world, usually, not everyone, but most people in the real world, in spite of how fat they are, find love.
Yes.
And so...
Well, and I think it's important for people... I think people forget that there are people out there who are attracted to people of different body types.
Exactly.
Like, the older you get, the more experience you have in relationship, in physical relationships. Sometimes what you think you're attracted to from when you're a little kid or when you're in high school and you don't have any romantic experience, you look at a picture and like, wow, that's hot. And then you actually, like, come in physical contact with someone and realize what's attractive to you physically on an intimate basis varies.
Yes.
And that's what maturity is when it comes to romance. And so, James Gandolfini is a lot of people's type.
Yeah.
Maybe not. He might not be the norm if you want to make it into math, but like, there are a lot of people who find him really attractive.
I watched this movie intentionally putting that in the back of my head.
Yeah.
Because that's my type. Look,
okay.
I'm going to get real here.
Yeah.
That's my kind of man.
Okay.
That big dude.
Yeah.
Right? And so I sat through the movie thinking, all right, you are the weird minority of people who look at James Gandolfini and think, he's beautiful.
Gotta get me some.
He's beautiful.
I'm gonna
slice
off
a piece
of that.
When The Sopranos came on TV, I thought,
put it on the plate.
Who is that beautiful man?
Yeah.
And that's my kind of dude right there. Big and fat. I like him.
All right.
Like Missy Elliott says, cute face, chubby waist. Make me do a double take.
Oh, and personality counts for so much, honestly, yeah, also
and
as well.
So I intentionally put that in the back of my head, like, okay, yeah, you have to divorce your own sort of, like, first of all, sadness that he's dead. Secondly, lust. You have to get those out of your head while you watch this film. And I went into that knowing this. But, and so, well, in spite of those things, what I really appreciated was the idea that this guy is now a romantic lead in this film, and just deal with it. And the idea that these women are now going to sit around and critically dissect his body, which is fascinating, and you never get that in a movie.
It's very rare. There was a commercial.
Women's bodies are constantly under scrutiny, and men's are not.
There was a trailer playing in front of Battle of the Year for... what's that? It's a new adaptation of that David Mamet play, Sexual... Perversion in Chicago.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's
about last night.
Yeah, about last night. So there was like a trailer for that, and like a bunch of other films of its ilk.
It's a remake playing in front of last night.
There was a lot of scenes. I saw, like, in three trailers in a row, there were scenes where people were talking about this person they went out with last night. Oh, I can't believe I slept with them. And when they discussed them, they were like, oh, he was so hot.
Yeah.
Or, oh, her body was so banging.
Right.
And I'm like, that is okay. That's okay. But, like, I mean, that's conceivably possible. But, right, like, when you meet someone, you know, there might be issues that you have with them. And I'm really sick of any time in a movie when someone has an issue with someone that maybe I'm worried about it down the road. That it has to be like in Boomerang, where like Eddie Murphy slept with this really, she seemed really nice. And then she had like janky feet.
Janky feet, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, and
like gnarled up
feet. Yeah, like, okay, and I'll grant you, like, that might be a turnoff. But like, is that it? Is that how superficial you are? Because that honestly, that just makes you feel really superficial. Or it makes your world seem completely unrealistic.
Yeah.
And here's a film, where they do talk about that in a refreshingly open way.
Yeah.
I just wish it had been on both sides. I realize this is told from very much from a woman's perspective, and and Julie Reed-Dreyfuss's character is really richly realized. Mm-hmm. All her flaws and all her strengths, they're really there.
Yeah.
And I really admire that. But again, it's a film about judging people, and I think when you tie the audience's, like, when you cover one of the audience's eyes, you know, I think you're doing that a little bit of a disservice. And I would have liked to have seen James Gandolfini. You know, it's almost like there's like a really laid-back, pathetic version of the Manic Pixie Dream Girl in some romantic comedies, where it's like the really bland dream guy. Like, the example of this is My Big Fat Greek Wedding, which is, it's cute. It's a cute movie. I got nothing against it, really. But, like, John Corbett plays the guy, and that's it. He's nothing else. He's perfect.
Right.
We see one scene with him and another guy, which is just sort of there to justify that he really is attracted to her, because otherwise, how could he be? And like, that's it. And
she's,
like,
such a gross mutant. She's a perfectly attractive woman.
Yeah.
And
I get that she had body issues earlier, and that maybe she might be insecure still, but like
a normal bodied
person.
But
like, why does this guy have to be? He's perfect because we're told he is in this movie. And here's a movie where I think this would be a really good example of, because we're really kind of analyzing that level of judgment and neurosis. And it would have been nice to have had a little bit of it from his, even if it was just at the end.
Yeah.
Like, after all the judgments or whatever, like, maybe then we get like one scene where it's just him and his daughter. And it feels really, and we see, because it's really judgmental about that daughter too.
Yeah.
She's a real snob. If we'd maybe had like one scene with them where they just kind of talk and we see a different side of them that they don't show to other people or that you wouldn't see if you were in the room with them for various reasons, I think that might have enriched the film significantly. I'm not trying to tell her how to do her job. I'm just telling her why it didn't work.
Take that, Jessica Alba.
How dare you? Jessica Alba, nay, Nicole Holofcener. Wouldn't that be great if we found she took off the mask? It's me, Jessica Alba. I was brilliant this whole time. Anyway, we have one more film to talk about. One more new film to talk about.
Which one is that?
Prisoners.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
It's all right.
Yeah, it's okay.
It's okay.
I've seen a lot of heaping spoonfuls of praise dumped on Prisoners.
You know why?
I have ideas.
I have an idea.
Tell me if you agree
with that idea.
It's your show.
Roger Deakins.
Yes! Roger Deakins. I was watching this movie and I didn't realize, because there's no front credits to Prisoners. It's just Prisoners, bam, movie, which I kind of like, actually. I just get the movie started.
Kidnapping.
Yeah. basically. And at the end of the movie, I'm like, I was watching this movie. I'm like, this movie is pretty.
It's gorgeous.
There's this one scene where it's like, it's not really a car chase, but it's like a high speed car moving on a freeway.
It's terrifying. And
it's the prettiest I've ever seen, yeah, like a freeway ever.
It's more than pretty.
Yeah.
It's emotionally jarring.
Oh, I know. It's overwhelming. Mm-hmm. The light, the way that he blows out the lights is so overwhelmingly dramatic.
Gorgeous.
Yeah. And I was watching it, and I was like, I named Roger Deakins. And I'm like, oh, there you go.
It is the most beautiful, miserable film I've seen in a long time. Well, it's an ordeal.
Here's the thing with this movie, though. This movie's okay for to so set up.
Two children are kidnapped on Thanksgiving.
Yeah,
they
belong to two sets of parents.
Two sets of parents who are neighbors and best friends.
Mm-hmm.
Hugh Jackman and Maria Bello. Mm-hmm. Their little 6-year-old daughter is kidnapped. Viola Davis and Terrence Howard, their little 7-year-old daughter, was kidnapped.
I didn't even pick up on the age difference.
Together, they're 6 and 7.
Yeah.
And then, we can't actually tell you anything more about the plot.
It's in the trailer. There's stuff in the trailer. Here's the gist of it.
Jake Gyllenhaal, who has lost
a
good chunk of weight.
Yeah,
to be that gaunt and haunted looking.
Yeah, and even then, he still looks a little too cute for this.
A little bit.
Yeah,
but I, jumping ahead a little bit, I think it's his movie.
No, and this is part of my problem with it. Yeah. So he's a detective. He's trying to help out.
Yes.
And this is in the trailer, so it's really not a spoiler. But just to give you a little bit of framework, as they're trying to figure out who kidnapped these girls, they run into a prime suspect played by Paul Dano, who's sort of a man-child.
Yes.
We don't know if he's even capable of doing anything as ornate as this.
He's either mentally ill or stunted in some way.
Something is definitely wrong with him. And Jake Gyllenhaal decides that he's not a real suspect.
Right.
Hugh Jackman, who has nothing else to go on, decides that he is, and decides to kidnap and torture him to try to find out where the little girls are. That's all we'll tell you.
Yeah.
Because again, that's the setup. That's first half hour.
Yeah.
Of a 2.5-hour movie.
2.5 hours.
Now here's the thing. This movie, let's ignore the length and the cinematography for a second. This movie is a very nicely constructed mystery. A lot of clues, a lot of red herrings, very fun.
Yeah.
It's got a little something on its mind. It really wants to treat the despair of the crime more seriously than a lot of other films.
Yes.
Which is fine. I've seen it before, that's fine.
A lot of despair going on, yeah.
Yeah, that's fine. That's good. That keeps everything dramatic and involving. It's got a detective who is, like, really perfect. Like, a major plot point is he's never lost a case.
He's never been wrong.
And his name is Detective Loki.
He's Claire Danes without the crime.
Prisoners, a new Detective Loki mystery.
Yeah.
And all that's fun. All of that, I describe it as an airplane novel. Yes. You know, that's a fun little flick.
Yes.
The movie is extremely dour. And the movie takes itself incredibly seriously. This movie is like a fun... This movie would be like an Ashley Judd thriller if it was made in 1998.
Uh-huh.
But since it's made now... And this is like the Dark Knight of kidnapping, like, airplane thrillers. Everything is taken so seriously, and it's like... It feels like it's trying so hard to be an Oscar movie that it's sort of... does the fun mystery element a disservice.
Uh-huh.
And it's fun because, like, it's dramatic. It's suspenseful. Fun in a Hitchcockian way.
Right.
Like, this is a really fun story. I enjoyed it.
Not fun as in child murder and abuse.
No. But in terms of there's a crime that needs to be solved, I'm engaged, I want to know who did it. I want the heroes to succeed. I want the bad guys to fail. I want to find out who the bad guy is. I want to see if the person who I thought was the bad guy is the bad guy.
Right.
And it kind of was, but all right, that's fine.
I figured out who the bad guy was about 2/3 of the way through.
I was hovering around the right answer. It's a mystery. They give you these clues, and I think that's half the fun is everyone else is trying to figure out who, like, the kidnapper is.
Yeah.
I want to find out too, and I'm paying attention so that when these clues come up again, they'll satisfy me. And I wasn't, like, 100% right. I was hovering around right.
There's a thing that happens. Where they come across another dead end?
Yeah, it's another red herring.
Two thirds away, I thought, oh, okay, I bet I know who it is now.
As soon as we saw the little sketches he'd made on the wall,
I remember this
earlier scene, which was like this big glowing, like light shining on it clue that no one talks about, and I'm like, well, that's going to be important.
That's a clue.
That's a clue.
Yeah.
That's going to be important later. But listen, this movie, and here's the thing, just because it takes itself way too seriously and just because it feels 45 minutes too long, mm-hmm. doesn't mean it's bad. It's actually pretty good. It's well acted. Everyone's fine in it. It is gorgeous. It reminded me of like the remake of Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, which took a very fun pot boiler with some interesting ideas. And
trashy.
But you know what? Yeah. It had some themes. Like, it was actually like, it had themes. I'm going to get into Film Critic Society for sure.
Yeah.
No, but like it was about something.
But I'm sorry, but you're not. Your application has once again been denied.
Dang
it! We don't feel you're there yet.
but the thing with the original Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is, you know, it was a film that, you know, had like a pretty, it was a serial killer story, it was a hacker story, it was a female revenge story, and it was all centered around a basic theme of misogyny.
Yeah.
And here's a movie that's, you know, it's a murder, it's a kidnapping mystery, it's a vigilante story, it's a detective story, but it's all centered around the ideas of despair. And that's fine, but I feel like, much like David Fincher's Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, this feels like it's trying to be bigger than the actual story warrants.
Yeah.
And that, again, and kind of like with Enough Said, I just feel like the way that they handle the story they got does the film a disservice, and it ends up being pretty good as opposed to great, which I think it could have been with a little bit more narrative focus.
There's also a weird religious element going on throughout the movie that I found bothersome.
Just pretentious.
You can
is
go.
What it is.
You can go read about it on my review.
It's
on
really movies.com. It's really forced. It's like it's another thing where it's desperately trying to have meaning.
Yeah.
When in actuality, like you didn't, you could have taken that out, and actually the film would have been stronger for not like really calling. It opens with someone saying a prayer,
the Lord's
like
prayer,
really pretentiously, like really whispering, like.
Yeah.
And
Hugh Jackman is saying.
Hugh Jackman saying it like off screen, over a shot of a wilderness and like a doe and like a deer, a it's female deer, like, you know,
doe was a deer, it a female deer,
yeah. Right. But yeah, and it's like, and then this like opening scene, it's like, what's it now, let me down to sleep, like what's the Lord's Prayer again? Because I don't know this religion thing. Help me out with the religion thing. What's the Lord's Prayer? Yeah. Then say half whisper it, so it's important.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name.
Too fast.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven.
That bam! Shoot a deer!
Boom, shoot a deer.
Yeah, like, oh, I get it, it's important. Yeah, I don't really care. It's pretty good. I recommend seeing it at some point, you know, if how we described it doesn't make it sound impenetrable.
Were you never?
I don't know which one's called the Lord's Prayer.
Did you never go to church?
I've gone to church for weddings and funerals.
I see.
And I was dragged to church twice, but it was like a Protestant church.
So you're Catholic?
Yeah. Well, no. Here's the thing. My grandparents were Catholic. My parents were lapsed Catholics,
right.
And that makes me an agnostic. So my kid's gonna be like a priest.
Your
basically.
Last name means you're Catholic, though.
Yes, it does. It's Italian. It means I'm Catholic. Anyway, so that would be that. What else do we have to cover on this?
That is it.
That's it. We don't have anything. We don't get to knife someone.
Oh, we do.
Oh, do we? Oh my.
Would you like to do a DVD recommendation first?
I'm trying to think. If anything's coming out that's like super special, man. I just saw, okay, this isn't like a huge recommendation, but I think it's going to fly under everyone else's radar.
We only like huge recommendations.
I'm sorry. Stephen Knight, the guy who wrote Dirty Pretty Things, I think Eastern Promises as well.
Yes.
He wrote and directed a film called Redemption, which is coming out on DVD next week. It stars Jason Statham. And it's very much like his other shtick, which is like,
have
here's.
Have you seen this?
I don't think so. It's pretty much going straight to video.
Did it not have a theatrical release?
I don't
think
it did. No. And it's too bad because it's a pretty good movie.
And we all know that you are Gatham for Statham.
I am spectacularly Gatham for Statham. And as I've said many times before, my ultimate dream as a human being is to one day snort coke off of his head. and here's the thing. Stephen Knight, if you look at those like three films I just mentioned, you'll find that each of them is like a crime story set in England that takes like what could be a very pulpy storyline and tries to inject it with more character and humanity. And two varying degrees of success, I think. Redemption, I think, is the least successful, but it's actually a pretty good movie. Jason Statham plays a war veteran, like the Afghanistan conflict or one of those. They're actually not too specific about it.
Right.
And he took some justice into his own hands at some point. So, you know, he's trying to stay off the radar. He's living as a homeless guy. And he ends up lucking into an apartment that is, like, fully furnished and vacant for, like, 6 months.
Right.
So he ends up staying there, you know, sort of eking money from the guy's bank account, trying to get himself back on his feet, and trying to... And trying basically trying to redeem himself, hence the title Redemption. But he keeps falling back into organized crime.
Like you do.
Like you do. Well, he's not good at anything else, and he can't get a legal job because he's if they don't find out who he was, he'd be arrested.
Right.
And it's got like a subplot with like a woman who he used to share a cardboard box with, who got killed, and he's trying to find out who did it. And he's got like a love affair going with a nun, and that sounds more lurid than it actually is. There's like a lot of doubt about it. He's just like really attracted to her, and she doesn't want to do anything. And I'm really not selling it very well because I only just saw it last night. But like it sounds
like a lot of whatever.
It sounds like a lot of whatever. But it's like it's actually like you know. It's probably Jason Statham's best performance, like as an actor.
Yeah.
You know, like he's pretty good. It's very nicely shot.
I don't know what that looks like.
Yeah, like it's very lovely. It's very nicely shot. There's some good character work in there. If you think you've seen every Jason Statham movie, you haven't because you haven't seen Redemption yet.
That's right.
That's all I'll say.
My DVD recommendation is not a movie. It is season one of Hannibal.
Oh, it's so good!
And the reason
I love that
I
show.
Am doing this is because my lovely friend, Brian Fuller, is the creator and boss of Hannibal.
Oh, I didn't know you knew Brian Fuller.
And it's his baby.
He's doing a spectacular job.
And I'm really, really happy that it's not been canceled because everything he does gets canceled.
And it would have ended on a cliffhanger, too, which would have been annoying. Hannibal is a show that, and the premise of Hannibal is it's the Thomas Harris universe writ large over many, many episodes.
Yeah.
And starting with, like, before Manhunter.
Yes. So that's, I mean,
or before Red Dragon, if you want to go.
If you're a fan of Mr. Fuller's earlier shows like Pushing Daisies or Wonderfalls, and were always sort of like disheartened when they went away from television so quickly, here it is—the thing that probably will not die now.
And the thing is that I remember hearing that concept and going, "This is going to suck."
Yeah.
This is a terrible idea. I don't care if Brian Fuller is doing it. This is a terrible idea for John.
I trust
the show is excellent.
So much.
Yeah.
He's so clever and smart.
This show is great.
And
it's really a brilliant
show.
He
thinks in pictures and he's...
No, there's some amazing visual storytelling.
He's one of the most talented, awesome people I've ever known in my life.
I'm going to...
And I'm very happy that this is happening.
I'm going to second that with like another one that's just coming out. I think it came out last week, though.
Yeah.
Bates Motel. Another one that's like, this is a prequel to Psycho as a TV series. This sounds terrible.
Yes.
So much fun. It's a lot of fun. It's campier than you think it is. It has a really Twin Peaks vibe. Vera Farmiga is amazing.
She's great. Vera Farmiga is great.
But she's like, she plays it like you think of like Norman Bates' mom and you think this horrible, domineering monster of a woman. She's funny.
Yeah.
She's sympathetic and funny. And yeah, she's screwing up her kid really bad, but like...
he will become a murderer.
He will. And they play with that a couple of times where it's just like, oh, is this where he's going to crack? Is this where he's going to crack?
Right.
And it really works for some excellent drama. Bates Motel, I'm going to just second just another variation on that prequel to a movie franchise that's a better TV series than it has any right to be. Hannibal's better. Letters.
All right. The first two are not lists, but I know you're excited about knifing somebody. The last one is a list.
Oh, man. This is so cool.
Here's the first one.
Well, I was going to get veto power on that.
This is a letter that I there are actually still some more Your Next Mask entries.
Yes.
That I did not read last week, but I do want to read the ones that we got on the air, even though the ones I'm reading are all people who lost. Because our winner was the haiku guy. But here's one that I have not read yet. Hello, fellows. Upon hearing about your most recent contest, I was filled with a giddy joy usually reserved for the Halloween season's plethora of high-concept haunted houses. Yes, I'm a 42-year-old child. I feel no shame for my addiction to the occasional horror films and, like Mr. Dave White, require a fix from time to time to release those endorphins. And no, horror isn't my 100% genre of choice. My favorite films are diverse and include The Red Shoes, Beautiful Thing, The Last Picture Show, The 39 Steps, Wild Strawberries, The Living End, but I digress. Sorry, that's terribly pretentious and boring.
That's what we're all about here on Linoleum Night.
Anyway, you're next. Untrue?
Well, when I'm here, it is.
When you're here, yes. Yeah. Anyway, your next was a breath of fresh air. I loved the film and was so glad it finally got the wide release. It deserves. The young directors involved are really receiving some well-deserved attention. I need the wolf mask, guys. Not just because of my fanboy-like over-the-top gushing over this film since 2011, but also to take it to work and wear it as I work in my lovely, tiny, veal-fattening pen-style cubicle. I would wear the mask on the back of my head as I face... with my back to passersby. I know several high-strung, jumpy people that would most likely need therapy after passing by to drop off reports or simply breezing by and poking in their head. The fun would not simply end there. Oh no, I would proudly display the mask on my bedroom office wall with a vintage frame to border and accentuate the creepy little guy. My partner would tolerate this, as horror isn't really his thing. I know the contest rules stated 50 words, so the second paragraph is my official entry. Thank you for reading, and keep up the great work and incredibly entertaining show. All the best, Isaac. Sorry, Isaac, you lose, but thank you for that.
It was lovely, though.
Letter, that was really good.
He deserves a wolf mask. Yes. Also, I got to say, I got a similar mask, actually. Yeah. I got the sheep mask.
Yeah.
You can't see anything out of that
mask. You can kind of see a little bit.
Like you couldn't kill someone in that mask. No. Like they'd have the massive
orchestrate the kind of mask.
Stormtroopers have better vision.
Yeah.
Than the killers in your next, apparently. What else we got?
This is from James in London, who has written to us before. He writes, I'll tell you why I go to the cinema a lot less nowadays. This is in response to the beginning of How to Go to the Movies, an ongoing series that has just had its first installment on linoleum-knife.com.
Okay.
As soon as Duralde gets back from Kosovo, you'll see part two.
Okay.
He wrote, because people seem incapable of surviving through a two-hour film without eating and drinking ridiculously oversized buckets of drinks, popcorn, hot dogs, nachos, and any other overpriced rubbish the cinema thinks people will shove down their gaping maws. If I wanted to sit next to people eating, I'd go to a Greasy Spoon Cafe and watch the world go by. Any cinema that banned food and drink would get my vote big time.
Wow.
Here endeth the rant, James in London. I cannot get with that.
I think you're permitted. I think that we do need to be careful what kind of snacks are allowed. You know, I think anything too crunchy.
Stinky crunchy ones,
very, very bad. Listen, I love there are a lot of movie theaters around here that'll offer a glass bottle of Coke.
Yeah.
Like a Mexi-Coke.
Yeah.
With real sugar, and they're fantastic. But inevitably someone will drop it and then you'll just hear it roll slowly down the aisle.
Like the good old days.
Yeah, like the good old days. And it's just terrible. I want to share a quick experience I had, actually, when I went to see Rush, and I missed the critic screening because I was at another screening, so I saw it with a movie-going audience, and they were very enthused, and they liked it a lot. There was a guy with an e-cigarette in there.
What?
And it's like, I realized that we're still kind of figuring out the rules in e-cigarettes, because this is just water vapor, it's not like secondhand smoke.
I know.
Let me tell you something. That is really distracting, because it's this thick, even if it's water vapor, it's still a thick plume of smokiness going through a giant light projecting a movie.
Yeah.
And I realize there's a lot of scenes in Rush where people are smoking anyway, so it's like a 3D effect almost.
Yeah.
It's really distracting.
Yeah.
And I think we need to clarify that that isn't allowed either. I sympathize with your plight, but no, that is part of the rule. You don't get to do that.
But the lady who put all the fried chicken in her purse, she gets the thumbs up.
The person who was...
I will always love you, lady with the fried chicken in your purse. I don't know who you are, but you're my role model.
One more thumbs down to the person who was sitting behind me at Enough Said on Wednesday afternoon at the Landmark Westside Pavilion. Mm-hmm. If you're going to play Candy Crush in the middle of a movie, at least mute it. At least mute it. I beg of you.
Did you harsh on him real hard?
I don't remember what I did.
Did you make it stop?
I said something and it stopped and I was.
Did you say swears?
No, I didn't say. No, I never lead with swears.
Really?
Turn it off. Or if they're really close, that's if they're far away from me, they can't tell who I am. If they're close enough, I'll be like, excuse me, that's really distracting. Would you turn that off, please? Like, I'll try to do that. But we agree to these rules when we enter a movie theater. These are the rules we all agreed to.
I like to say, kill you now!
I've heard you say that many a time. What do we got next?
Hi, Alonzo and Dave.
Hi. I'm Alonzo.
Fake Alonzo.
I... can't do. Lonzo really doesn't have like a signature voice or anything. I
just
really
now
do an
caught
impression.
The episode of the B Movies podcast that you two were on, in which you all listed your top films of this decade so far, and I was inspired to make my own list of the same theme.
Aww.
Number 10.
Okay.
I Saw the Devil.
Okay. I actually didn't see that one.
Number 9. I did. Yeah. It's good. Not bad.
Okay.
Yeah. Number 9, Bridesmaids.
I don't love that movie as much as everyone else does, but it's really good and it's really refreshing. So, yeah, that's a good one.
Cabin in the Woods.
Yes. Great movie.
He writes, it's a game changer for the horror genre because it calls for the game to be changed.
Well, yeah.
7. Basically. The Social Network.
Excellent film. I prefer Summer Wars, as we discussed on that show, but Social Network is an excellent film.
Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Great movie.
Yeah,
I love that movie. Ezra Miller in that movie breaks my heart a little bit.
It was just snuck up on me and affected me for a long time after I first saw it. The first time I saw it, I thought it was a great high school movie. The second time I saw it, I couldn't stop weeping. Number 5, Holy Motors.
I'm still ashamed to admit that I haven't seen that yet.
Number 4.
I know.
Number 4, A Separation.
Love, and I put that on my list as well. I love that movie.
Number 3, Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Very good film.
And he wrote, I know what y'all are going to say, and I will preemptively respond with, shut up.
You know what? Alonzo isn't here, so I get to be the one defending that film. That film is a really beautiful film.
It is a really beautiful film.
And on a variety of different levels, I think that movie is excellent.
It is a really beautiful film.
Yeah.
That infuriated me and filled me with anxiety.
Anxiety is fine. I think it's supposed to fill you with anxiety. It didn't infuriate me. I was transported.
Yes.
Yes, I thought it was fantastic.
Toy Story 3.
Beautiful.
Upstream Color.
Yes!
Yeah.
Good taste there.
So it's already impacted me on more of a profound level than most films I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for reading this letter. Sorry for my difference of opinion, especially for number 3. Hope I'm not reprimanded too harshly.
No, you're going to be fine this week. Yeah. I didn't see two of them. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt.
How much of a knife is that?
I give him the benefit of the doubt, and the two I haven't seen.
Mm-hmm.
That's a 10. That's a 10. I don't like all those movies that much.
No, that's not how we do it.
Okay.
What percent knife is he?
He's 100% knife on my end. What about you?
90 on mine.
What's the one where they
Beasts,
lose it?
Beasts, dude.
No. He's not even allowed to enjoy Beasts. He's not allowed to have Beasts as one of his favorite films?
No.
All right. So that's that would be
he
a 90.
He knows the rules. He listens to this show.
The aggregate is a 95% knife.
You are good at math.
Thank you.
I'm not.
Alonzo, by the way, who is now listening to this, and like,
math
is like
brainiac.
Is, well, yeah. Right now he's digging his fingernails into his fists in fury because I gave Beasts a pass. He does have veto power on this.
No, he doesn't. He's a Kosovo.
All right, screw it. All right, yeah.
Rules don't apply.
95% knife. You got lucky this time.
Yeah.
Is there anyone else who want to do before we go? Or
that's the end.
That's the end. Okay.
For the end.
Dave, where can people find your work?
In the garbage dump.
Where it belongs. Where can people find you online, Dave?
Movies.com.
Okay.
Twitter.
Yeah.
I'm D. Leland White on
Twitter.
Yes, you
are. Don't search for Dave White. Good luck.
You'll die trying.
Good luck. Yeah.
I'm D. Leland White. My middle name is Leland. L-E-L-A-N-D.
Yeah. As well it should be.
D. Leland White also on Facebook. If you go to kcrw.org and type in unfictional, you'll find me on about half a dozen episodes there.
Yep.
I did a live event with them this past week. It was me and 9 famous people, so by extension, I too was famous.
Yes!
On Monday night. And,
anything else? Anything else you want to share with us? Movies.com?
Did I say movies.com?
I don't remember you saying
I am the film critic of movies.com.
Yes, you are.
That's all. Oh, all right. I'm one of the big bosses at linoleum-knife.com.
That's right.
That's where you can find me.
I'm working on getting
Alonzo
a cake there
list
myself.
Alonzo has a list of podcasts that I listen to, but I don't remember what those are ever.
I'll
listen to the B Movies podcast.
That's B.
And my brother and me.
Yeah.
There's a really good medical one called Sawbones that I'm into now.
What? What's it about?
And
how does that work?
I like The Conversation, which is an art podcast, but I'm...
Okay.
I have like 4 friends that are into art, like I am.
Okay.
So I don't expect anyone else to want to listen to that one.
Right, okay.
But yeah.
All right.
Tell them everything about you.
You can find my various musings at cravenline.com. I'm the film channel editor there.
Yeah.
I'm the lead film critic there.
That's right.
I host... I co-host the B-Movies podcast with my hetero life mate, Whitney Seibold. You can find that on iTunes. You can find that at Crave Online as well. You can find me on Twitter at William Bibbiani. That's B-I-B-B-I-A-N-I. You can hear me every Friday morning at around 9:45 at
Pacific time.
980 AM radio, KFWB. You can, I just did a guest stint on for like a quarter of an episode on the Schmoes Note podcast this week. I'm part of a new podcast that's going to be all about the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. television series every week.
Oh, really?
It's called S.H.I.E.L.D. Cast. And we made CAST into an acronym as well. So CAST stands for Critical Analysis Strike Team. I'm on there with Andrew Robinson and Gwen Reyes and Rodimus Prime. And
that's perfect.
Yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun. So that's going to start coming out next week.
We're going to have a lot to talk about.
Oh, he should come on sometime. It'll be great.
He's so excited to
I'm
watch
super
that
excited
show.
About it. And I got a couple of web series coming out next month. There's going to be a 6-episode series we're calling The Chucky Files, in which I interview for about 10, 20 minutes a pop Child's Play creator Don Mancini. About every single Child's Play movie. So there's 6 episodes total. Each one's really in-depth. I think you're going to enjoy it. And then I'm doing the Kings of Horror on YouTube with Shock Till You Drop editor Ryan Turek, where every day, 31 episodes throughout the month of October, we're reviewing a different horror movie based on the works of Stephen King. So I really hope you watch that one in particular, because that's a lot of work for us. So please give it a watch, tweet it out, send it out. We'd really appreciate it. Hashtag Kings of Horror, all that good stuff.
Hashtags.
Some of my favorite lines of the year in Olympus Has Fallen, where he's got to press the button to defuse the bomb, and it's like, two, hashtag, what the hell are you talking about? I love that. Dave, let's take us out on an important poetic or metaphysical note.
Goodbye.